Right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our January lecture. I think I know most of you in the room. My name is Bill Foster. I took over as chair this year, and it'll be my pleasure to be introducing most of these, I think, for the next 12 months. Just before we start, you'll see a list there of our forthcoming events, just for your diary. The technical visit to the Royal Opera House is now fully subscribed, but we may be able to run another one later in the year. They've been very kind and said they could probably entertain another group. For anybody who's got, actually that website, that is actually wrong, the time there, it's 10:45 for anybody who's going. We had to bring it forward an hour because there is a rehearsal in the main auditorium and we want to be able to see the main auditorium before the rehearsal starts. So it will start at 10:45 and it will be at the entrance, the stage door in Floral Street. We'll be sending those who are going on the tour, we'll send them an email in the next week or so to give them the full details. Our Audio for Visuals Symposium in Beaconsfield at NFTS, that's coming along. We've got the programme virtually finished. We've got one more speaker to confirm, but we've got a day there which is targeted very much at people, freelancers who perhaps want to look at other aspects of the industry, and also students who want to know a bit more about what's going on. We'll have a group of experts who are practitioners in their various fields of audio for games, audio for film, audio for television, cinema, and the like, and they will be giving their experience and explaining some of what goes on in their particular part of the business. And it's a very reasonable £68. We've kept the cost right down. That includes a lunch and teas and coffees and things. So even if you're not going yourself, if you bring it to the attention of anybody you think might be interested, the members rate is there. And we're also actually opening it up to a couple of the other UK associations for their members. And next month here, we've got a very interesting lecture on the restoration of an EMI Red 51 mixing console, which was the type of console used at Abbey Road during the era when the Beatles made most of their records. It's the one with all the sort of kind of the old quadrant faders and what a very, very old desk. And it's now installed at British Grove at Mark Knopfler's studio. And Brian Gibson, who did the restoration, will be talking to us. And then in March, we have a mastering workshop with a group of UK mastering engineers talking about what they're doing and the challenges they're facing today. And then finally in April, Keith Howard, our past chairman until this year, he's going to be talking on harmonic phase. And we've got more coming up during the course of the year, and they'll be posted as usual on our website, aes-uk.org. But now on to this evening. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Josh Rees, who's the senior lecturer at Queen Mary's University, which I'm sure you all know. And Josh is going to be talking about intelligent audio editing technologies, and I think, judging by what I've seen of the abstract, a very interesting evening. Looking forward to that. Josh.
Okay, so thank you very much. I should point out that the talk I'm going to give today is describing research by a wide variety of different people from the center that all falls loosely under this title. So contributions from Enrique Perez-Gonzalez, Alice Clifford, Daniela Borghese, Marcus Zornsham, Demetrius Giannoulis, and Michael Masberg. So the outline of the talk is as follows. Start off, goals and motivation. So what do I mean by intelligent audio editing? And talk about the technology sort of from the simple level up to the most advanced. So first talk about adaptive effects and focusing on one, a transient modifier. Then adaptive automatic effects, so an automated dynamic range compressor. Then cross-adaptive effects, which is sort of the core of the work, and this is automatic mixing. So technologies that attempt or assist in the mixing and try as much as possible to automate many of the tasks that are handled ordinarily, manually. And finally, I'll move on to perhaps the most advanced, which is cross-adaptive with feedback. These are tools that allow someone to reverse engineer a mix. So given the multi-tracks and the final master, it will try to find out all of the settings on all of the effects that went into producing that master. So, let's talk about the motivation. Well, this article appeared actually after we started researching this area, but it really encapsulates the goals and the ideas about what we're trying to do. So in an editorial for Sound on Sound, Paul White wrote, "There's no reason why a band recording using reasonably conventional instrumentation shouldn't be equalized and balanced automatically by advanced digital audio workstation software." And we agree, at least up to a point, that there's many of these tasks where it should be possible to have the software accomplish at least an initial setting to produce higher quality than random, or at least to come up with rough settings that can then be tweaked and optimized by the engineer. So he went on to say musicians would rather get on with making music than get too deep into engineering. So we're not just trying to address the needs of the sound engineers, but also the musicians. There'll be many situations like a gig in a pub venue, for instance, where I've been to these, the sound engineer doesn't show up, or at the last minute the venue says, "Sound engineer? Oh, what is that? I didn't realize we needed one. This is the first time we put on a gig." Or the musicians are expected to provide their own. And so what is really needed in those situations is something that can give the band, in a small, non-mission critical situation, fairly decent sound, at least a starting point. It would be nice to essentially have good mixing software for practice, you know, when they're just playing together, to still have reasonable mixes being produced. And finally, one more point from the article: audio interfaces can come with a gain learn mode. Audio workstations could optimize their own mixer and plug-in gain structure while preserving the same mix balance. So the workstations themselves should be able to preserve the balance of the mix and really learn. It should be able to do some form of signal analysis and say, these are the signals coming into the mixer. We understand some of their properties, and hence some of the settings will be adapted to the signal content. Another bit of motivation comes from just looking at, in some sense, the state of the industry or the state of the market. And I am cheating a little here because I'm going to compare the camera with the multi-track recorder, and they're not really on an equal level. But if you look at modern digital cameras, so you go to Curry's or Dixon's and look at what they are promoting about the camera, and they'll all come with some variation on autofocus, auto flash, red eye removal, face detection, scene detection, and so on. But then I looked at a few audio recorders, and they all said things like the following: it can record anywhere. You can walk out and go into any environment and it can record. Interactively guides a new user on how to use it, and I thought this one was really funny. Rather than doing anything to automatically detect the face and the scene, if you get it wrong, it'll help you with a retry function to try and figure it out again. So a huge difference between the two. Why isn't there an auto-focused for audio? Now, I'm not here suggesting that the tool will do anywhere at close to the same level of a sound engineer. But if you look at things from the consumer perspective, the consumers aren't picking up on audio recording technology to anywhere close to the same level as they have invested in digital cameras and digital camcorders. And partly that's due to the quality of what they record, partly in terms of the hardware, but also partly in terms of the software. The cameras have embedded all of the digital signal processing into the device so that a complete amateur can still take a fairly decent photo. You know, in some sense, that's obvious. But it's not the same in the audio market at all. So those are a couple of the motivations. So the question then becomes, well, if we're going to try and build intelligent effects, which aspects of things are we're going to try and build them for. Well, if you look at music production and mixing, there's a wide variety of things that are done, a wide variety of skills that need to be learned, and different challenges. So they can be boiled down to technical constraints related to the electronics, the interface, the acoustics of the environment, and to aesthetic or artistic constraints. But even some of, what's the approach that we take, what's the style that people are generally looking for. But even many of those constraints are common practice. So one example is when stereo recording first came out, it used to be very common to hard pan things, very extreme. But now it's generally accepted that although there's a lot of stylistic decisions that can be made, hard panning isn't usually done. Lead vocals usually gets panned to the center. And so on. So when we think about those artistic decisions, are they really art or are they engineering? And I would say that really a lot of the common practice, those can be embedded as rules, as best practices in sound engineering. And so the only thing we aren't touching are the uncommon practices, the creative practices. When the sound engineer chooses to do something different than the standard approach or breaks the rules because they know something about the music, the genre, et cetera, that is necessitates doing things differently. So these intelligent effects aren't trying to mimic the creative decisions. Our goal is to construct intelligent systems for sound engineering and to basically do two types of things. Create a set of tools for the sound engineer that will automate the repetitive tasks, make his life simpler, make his life easier, and also to create sort of a black box system for the musician that will allow decent, not great, but decent live sound in the absence of a sound engineer. So in order to do that, we need to create intelligent systems, and by that we mean systems that can perceive, reason, learn, and act intelligently. So that means that they will perceive the content that's coming to them. They will make reasoned decisions about that content. They will learn based upon the signal or the signals that they're receiving, and they will act intelligently based on that information. Our requirements are to create systems that can be used both by the amateur, the sort of black box system, and by the expert, so something that will, say, get initial settings for them. And we're trying to create these intelligent systems and these intelligent effects for both post-production and live recording. In some sense, live is easier for us because people are more forgiving of errors in a live situation. And I don't mean systems that crash, I mean non-perfect sound. But to create an intelligent system that will mix offline anything close to what an engineer might do is much more challenging, whereas something that can essentially operate the mixing console at a level approaching what a live sound engineer can do, that's a bit more achievable. But in order to get it working in a live situation, we need tools that operate in real time with minimal latency. So the live criteria is much more difficult than just real time. Real time, you can have a few milliseconds latency, but in a live situation, if the guitarist plays a note and then 50 milliseconds later, you hear the processed version of that sound, that's not going to work. So we need minimal latency and we need stable systems. We can't have a system that is modifying the EQ, boosting some frequencies, and introducing feedback, acoustic feedback. So those are our conditions. And in order to create these systems, we use a few technologies that kind of enable them. So these are technologies to keep in mind when I describe the tools a bit later on. Adaptive digital audio effects. And by adaptive, that simply means an audio effect that will modify its action based on the signal it's receiving. So if you apply EQ to a signal, it's going to apply the EQ no matter what the signal it's receiving. On the other hand, a simple standard dynamic range compressor will modify the amount of compression it's applying because it uses peak or RMS measurements to determine the signal level. So compressors could be considered adaptive effects. But we're also going to introduce something that is fairly new, the idea of a cross-adaptive effect. So these are effects that could be termed multi-input, multi-output, or inter-channel dependent. And what that means is they look at all of the inputs coming into the system to determine how to process all of the outputs of the system. So for instance, if you're deciding the levels on a recording with multiple inputs, then you don't change the level on one without any knowledge of the others. You as a human would be listening to all of the inputs and deciding the appropriate level for any one of the inputs based on that information. We also use feedback digital audio effects. Those are ones where the output of the effect gets fed back into the system to determine further modification. In order to get things working in live situation, we use things like sidechain processing and accumulative feature extraction. So for the sidechain processing, that simply means that the audio is coming straight through the system, and then separate to that, we're processing the audio, we're extracting information about the audio. And we accumulate various information about the signals. So for instance, the spectral content of the signal, we build up an idea of the spectrum over time. So the effect tends to learn, and this happens quite rapidly. So if sound is being produced, it's being takes a few seconds to get an idea of the characteristics of that sound, or less than a few seconds, actually. And we have constrained control rules, so how do we decide things like what EQ to apply, what levels the faders should be set to? Well, those are based on knowledge of how a mixing engineer, for instance, would make those settings ordinarily, and we embed those rules into the system. And finally, we use things like reference microphones, so we're not setting the levels on a channel that is essentially silent, that is only picking up the ambient noise. We know what is the level in the environment. We have some idea of the acoustics in the environment. So for a live sound situation, we can gate or threshold our system so that we only process a channel when that channel is active. Okay, so I've covered most of this information here. The architecture that we use for at least the cross-adaptive effects is what's being shown. Multiple inputs coming in. We're extracting features on all of those inputs. And we then take that information and look at all of the features we're extracting to decide what control signals to apply to each to each channel, and hence produce the modified outputs on those channels. And all of the decisions come from best practices in sound engineering, which I should point out is quite a different approach from what one would often take in an academic environment, where a lot of people in, say, the fields of artificial intelligence and machine learning would not base things on sound engineering guidelines, but rather would say, give a system 1,000 examples of good mixes and let the system try to learn what a good mix is based on that. Ours is based on knowledge of some rules that are often done. So these are rules that, when you think about them, are far removed from the creative decisions. So how would one adjust the delays? Well, the first thing one would do with the delays is to try to prevent any cone filtering. So if you've got two microphones picking up one source, you align them in time so that they don't create notches in the spectrum. Stereo panning should be balanced. You don't want to create, say, a mix or produce a piece of music that is mostly coming out of the left speaker or the right speaker. You don't want any of the sources to be masked, either in space in terms of the panning or in terms of the spectral content. And so on. There's quite a lot of these rules, and most of them are well known. So let's start with one of the simplest effects in a sense. It's not a cross-adaptive effect. It's working on one channel, but the idea is, let me pause for a second, and because there are a few of these out on the market. So how many of you have heard of the transient modifier as an audio effect? Yeah. So a few hands went up, but only a few. So it's relatively new, and the idea here is that we want to amplify or suppress the transients in the signal and not affect any other parts of the signal. So it's a bit like dynamic range compression, except it's not meant to modify when the signal is loud or quiet, but rather when, say, a note is first struck. And so we want to build an intelligent one that does more analysis of the signals in order to determine how to do this a bit better. And we want to simplify the parameter settings, which we should be able to do. If we can look at the signal, we can determine how the parameters should be set the effect. So we had a few conditions with when we created this. We want to work with both hard and soft transients. In other words, we want to be able to, say, boost or suppress the transients in, say, a snare drum, but also in a violin sound. And we want to be able to work with polyphonic multi-voice recordings. In other words, we want to be able to boost the transients when there are many instruments playing at the same time. We also want not to introduce artifacts and for the tool to be able to run in real time. So, how did we create it? We essentially need two parts to the system. We need to be able to detect the transients, and we need to be able to modify the transients. So we looked at a wide variety of different functions that can analyze the signal in order to detect the transients. What we found worked best are functions that are also used for detecting the onsets. So there are ways to analyze a signal and determine when each note has been hit, even in polyphonic signals with fairly good accuracy. And those functions essentially have a measure of the likelihood of an onset. And when it's very close to being a strong likelihood of an onset, then we know that there's a lot of transient behavior in the signal. In terms of the modification, we then use that same function as well, where if there's a lot of transient behavior happening, then we apply more modification. And we then have to deal with a few issues. So in a polyphonic situation, a stand-up bass and a piccolo playing, then you could imagine a situation where some of the frequency range is very heavily associated with a transient from one instrument, while some of the frequency range is not associated with a transient. It's primarily due to the other instrument, and it might be mostly steady state. So our solution is to use a subband approach to do the detection and modification of the transients, where we look at the signal content over a short window of time, break it up into different subbands, and classify each subband as having some amount of transientness. And then we can only modify, and then we choose only to modify those subbands, those portions of the frequency spectrum that are highly transient. So, a few sound examples here. Two examples on the right, I'm showing some results of evaluation where we took standard procedure, took something like a dozen or 15 people, and in a Mushra style evaluation, we asked people to rank various different implementations, rank or rate various different implementations of a transient modifier. And one of them, the last one on the right, is it was a commercial plugin. And if you know the field of transient modifiers or the various different names they are, you could probably guess which one it was. And the one that's labeled bands, that's our one. So at least according to the evaluation, it seemed to perform highest. So the first example I'm going to give is on, let's see, this may take a second. There we go. Here we're trying to modify the transient parts from all sources. So the challenge is we've got multiple instruments playing at the same time. So here's the original without any transient modification. Let's see. Here we go. And using the plugin, so this is the commercial plugin. I had that wrong. That was our approach, and here is now is the commercial plugin, which should be fine because now you can compare the other way around. So what you should be able to hear there is that in the consumer plugin, those low amplitude transients associated with some of the instruments are not amplified as much as the other transients. One more example here, we're trying to suppress the transients. So here's the original. And here is our approach. And the plugin. Okay, so I'll move on to talking about intelligent dynamic range compressors. So here we're not just trying to build an adaptive high quality effect, but we're trying to build one that is fairly intelligent, in a sense, that does a lot more signal analysis. So anyone who uses a dynamic range compressor knows that there's a lot of good rules of thumb about how you would set it based on the signal that you're dealing with and the content of that signal. And a typical, here I'm not talking about a multi-band compressor, but a typical standard dynamic range compressor has at least five parameters: the threshold, ratio, attack, release. Well, I think here I've mentioned six of them. Threshold, ratio, attack, release, knee, which is not as common, but still quite there, and the makeup gain. And when you set a compressor to incorrect settings or poor settings, it will introduce various artifacts. And our goal then is to design a compressor where most of the current parameters can be automated. And here, the evaluation approach that we take is a bit different than in the last case. So here, what we did is we, I think it's on the next slide, or a couple of slides, so I'll keep you waiting. So what are the parameters I'm talking about here? Well, we have a threshold where the compressor becomes active, and a ratio associated with that threshold, how much it diminishes the strength of the signal once the signal is above that level. We can also have a hard or a soft knee, so the transition at that threshold. And then we've got these sort of time-dependent parameters, the attack and the release time, so how quick the compressor responds to the change, and how quickly it changes once the signal goes back down to a normal level. And finally, we've got the makeup gain, so that usually the signal would then be amplified to make it roughly equally as loud as the signal was before the compression. So our goal was to automate all of this, and then in terms of evaluation, we asked a lot of different experienced sound engineers, some who we called professional. So in other words, they use dynamic range compressors all the time in their work, so mixing engineers, producers, and so on, and some amateurs who are quite familiar with dynamic range compressors, but don't use them for a living. We asked them to set dynamic range compressors for a lot of different signals, and then we saw whether our system would give similar settings to what they did. So we tried to automate all of those parameters except one, where I believe, yeah, we left the compression ratio as just, oh, sorry, we left the threshold as the only human parameter. So essentially, the user had a system where they just said, I want this signal more compressed or less compressed. And then it would optimize the rest of the parameters. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play you the audio samples first, and then I'll do a bit of discussion about how the evaluation went and what we did. So here's an original sample of the bass. And after being automatically compressed, so and for everything I talk about today, there's more audio samples and more videos available. So if you want, you can go online and have a look and a listen. So how do we automate the attack and release? Well, when you have too short of an attack, then there can be distortion on the steady state part of a signal. Similarly, when you have a long release, then you can have dropouts after the transients because a new note has been hit and you're still essentially in the previous setting of the compressor. If you have a too long of an attack, then it will generate overshoots. It'll essentially compensate too much for too long a period of time. So we define maximum release and attack times, and then we get some measure of the transientness of the signal, as done before for the transient modifier, and we use that to scale the values of the attack and release times. So on the plots here, what we're showing is how the professionals and the amateurs set the attack time on top, the release time on bottom. So the median values of what they set things to are given by the dashes here. And then the pluses are what the automated system gave. So you can see that it's roughly within the same range. The y-axis in both cases is milliseconds. You can see that it's roughly the same range, but there are a few situations where we mess up slightly. So a bit, say, on the vocals. But then if you look at what the professionals set the attack time to on the vocals, they disagreed with each other quite a lot anyway. So we're within the range. We're within something like, I think, a 90% confidence interval. If we look at the knee, well, the knee width functions as a sort of an auto ratio. So the way that we approached it is we set the ratio to infinity to one, and then just adjusted the knee, so that you know if you way overshoot, if you have a very high amplitude, then it'll be close to infinite compression. What this does is it allows us to use the full range of compression that's possible, and essentially, if we need to apply more compression, we apply a soft knee. If we need to apply less compression, we apply a hard knee. And when there's a very transient signal, then there'll be a lot more variation in the knee with that signal. So here, the evaluation result showed that it worked fairly well. And then makeup gain was actually interesting because although it's the in some sense the simplest parameter, it was the hardest for us to work with. So a lot of dynamic range compressors do apply a form of makeup gain, but it's based on what the settings are on the compressor and what, based on those settings for a typical signal, the amount that the signal has been reduced. Instead, we basically get a measure of the loudness of the original signal, measure of the loudness of the signal after compression, and use that to compensate with the makeup gain. So it requires us to have a fairly good loudness model, and we needed to put a lot of sophistication into the loudness model to get it to work right. So one of the things we needed to look at is the durations of the loud parts of the signal and factor that into the loudness model. So it's based on loudness curves with a thresholding. Once we applied that, then we got fairly good results. And if we just tried to use sort of the average amount of compression that had been applied, then the results aren't very good. Instead, we need this loudness model. Okay, so what I've described so far is an adaptive audio effect and an intelligent audio effect, but none of this has been cross-adaptive. It's not really an automatic mixing system because it just processes a single channel. So the tools are essentially simpler, easier to use ones, but now I'm going to move on to talking about tools that really try to automate some of the production process in quite a more advanced way. So the first of that is an automatic panner, and given multiple inputs, it tries to determine how to put or where to put each of those inputs between the left and right speakers, so in the panning space. We made that decision based on a few concepts. So first, very low frequency sources, doesn't matter where you put them that much. We've got very poor resolution of the location of low frequencies, so those are generally put to the center. Higher frequency sources, we resolve quite well. So what we try to do is prevent spatial and spectral masking. In other words, if we've got two sources, say two female vocalists with roughly the same range, we're going to put them on either side of each other. If we've got three or four vocalists, then we spread them out over the space. But on the other hand, if we've got a very low frequency source and a very high frequency source, then those can be placed fairly close to each other without there being much masking. So we have all of these rules. They try and minimize the masking. They determine where we place all of the sources. We don't have here much knowledge of the sources. We don't know this was a guitar and this was a bass. Rather, we know it had this frequency content. So we know there's quite a lot of limitations in the system. You could have also a situation where a band is playing and really the lead guitarist is the most important person in the band. Our system doesn't know that. So our system might put him on the other side of the rhythm guitarist rather than putting the lead guitar's right center. So here's a demonstration of the system. It shouldn't need much explanation, should fairly well speak for itself. So we're going to start off with none of the sources panned and turn on the panner. And as each of the sources come in, it determines the appropriate setting for each of those sources. So now the panning is turned off, and turn it back on again, and it'll recalculate. Okay, so I'm going to cut most of the examples a bit short because in the interest of time. So that's the panning. Now, how about the gain and the faders? Well, here we obeyed a couple of simple rules. One is you just want to prevent clipping of any of the signals. So there's systems that have forms of automatic gain control. Our setting of the gains is not that different, where if any signal is being clipped, we lower it until it's not being clipped. If any signal is so low as to be inaudible, we raise it. That sets the gains. Then the faders need to be adjusted more continually because the signal levels might be changing over time. So The idea there is that signals, provided they are active, we try to have them approach equal loudness. That doesn't mean we make every signal exactly as loud as each other, but rather if one source is continually too low compared to the others, we raise that source. If one source is much louder continually, we lower that source. So they have what could be termed equal probability of being heard. So here's a demonstration of the automatic faders. There we go. So this is before they've been turned on. Now we prevent any clipping or distortion from setting the automatic gain. We haven't adjusted the faders yet, so the sources are at very unequal levels. Now we turn it on. So you can see a couple of the channels up there with the red lights next to them. What that means is we're not able to get the levels on those channels to have equal probability of being heard as the others. They're too extreme in their variation. That essentially indicates that if we want that channel's loudness range to be close to the others, then dynamic range compression needs to be applied. So this is indicating a potential use to embed an automatic multi-channel dynamic range compression into the system to improve the quality a bit more. Okay, so this is very applicable for live sound. In live sound, you can't automatically mix and have the system essentially introduce acoustic feedback. But if you're changing the levels on the sources, and if you're changing the EQ curves, then even if you leave a reasonable amount of headroom, there's still the possibility of feedback occurring. So you then have the challenge the other way, that for a lot of situations you want to make things as loud as possible. You might have a situation where the vocalist is very quiet compared to everyone else, so you need to turn up the levels there, but then it's quite common to introduce feedback because you've turned up the levels on the vocalist. So you need to have a balance where you have enough headroom not to introduce feedback, but not so much that it's a quiet gig. So there's a problem. You set up everything fine, the sound is great, and then a few conditions change, and during the live sound event, you realize, whatever you call it, the mid-range sounds a bit muddy, so I need to boost that a bit. But you know that if you boost any of the frequency content, you've only got so much headroom, you might be introducing feedback. So what do you do? Well, when I ask live sound engineers how do they deal with this situation, the first thing they usually tell me is, oh, I never have feedback problems. My gigs are always outstanding. It never happened before. I've always got just the right amount of headroom. And I say, never? And then they say, well, okay. It happens a few times, and then the answer is one of two things. Either it's like, well, I leave it sounding bad, because I don't want feedback. That's going to be the worst situation. Or the other answer is, and this is quite common, I turn down the levels on everything very slightly, so I've now got a bit more room to boost some frequency content or do whatever needs to be done, and I'm not going to introduce feedback. Well, the challenge in that situation is you don't know. You want to minimize how much you lower the levels on everything, because although you can do that without it being highly perceptible, and it might still allow you to deal with whatever is the problem in the mix, you don't want to do it too much. So you want to minimize the amount that you lower the levels on everything. And then you can do what you want without introducing feedback. So we're looking into that problem. There are a lot of tools out there to deal with feedback. These are things like adaptive filters, auto notch filters, frequency shifting. But first, you don't want to shift the frequency content in music. That might be great for speech intelligibility, but it's going to be a huge problem in music. Also, auto notch filtering. They try to introduce notches at every frequency where feedback could be occurring. Well, that's an awful lot. When looking at the auto notch filters, they often are introducing dozens or more notches into the spectrum. And supposing you have one of the sources being a nice, clean note sustained for a long time, that's going to look like feedback, and you don't want to notch out the music. So all of those systems are basically trying to deal with the feedback once it's occurring. And the difficulty there, or the approach that we took, is say, right, we're not going to deal with the symptoms of feedback. We're going to treat the cause of the feedback. We're going to try to prevent the feedback from occurring beforehand, rather than notch it out or remove it after it's occurring. So essentially, what we're trying to do in the simplest fashion is for that sound engineer who is lowering the levels on everything to do whatever processing he wants to do such that he can do it without any fear of feedback, we're freeing up one of his hands. He doesn't have to lower the levels while doing the other operation. The system will set the levels for him. So, quick background on acoustic feedback. Basically, you have an acoustic system with a couple of transfer functions. So you have the source going through a microphone, being equalized, and it doesn't have to be equalization. It can be nonlinear processing. It can be any types of effects happening there, getting amplified, and then output from the speaker. And then you've also got a feed forward path, which is essentially the acoustic path in the system. Well, if these two transfer functions are greater than one, then feedback is going to be introduced. Essentially, as the source gets amplified, goes back to the microphone, gets amplified, goes back to the microphone, we're increasing the that source each time it passes through the loop, at least at one frequency. So what we essentially need is to be able to modify the one part of the system we have the most control over, the mixing console, those operations that are being done. So if we have an equalizer gain where we know what the headroom is, it's been set to 0 dBs, then all we need to do is to enforce this equalization to remain below 0 dBs whenever we do any processing. It's not actually as simple as it sounds, because if I were, say, to apply just EQ, then I would know the transfer function of what has been applied. But if a lot of nonlinear processing is done, then I don't necessarily know the transfer function for what has been applied. So essentially, we pass an impulse through the system and get an estimation of the current transfer function. So here's the idea, where we lower the levels in order for us to apply some boost to the spectrum. And on your right-hand side here, here's a rough schematic of the processing that's being done. And it is a cross-adaptive effect as well, because any operation on any channel requires us to process all of the channels. So a little demonstration here. It's a bit different from the other ones. When we first announced this work, someone, a reporter for The New Scientist, got quite interested in it, and it got picked up and mentioned on BBC, World Service, and Guardian, and places, and the press had a field day with it because it's, oh, you know, scientists have discovered a way to prevent acoustic feedback. You'll never hear it again. I think a former member of Jesus and Mary Chain wrote a joking column in the Guardian about take my feedback away, do you? That's, you know, how I built my career. But of course, the other way of looking at it is all it's meant to do is free one hand up from the sound engineer on one task. Admittedly, a rather important task when that situation requires. But so here's one of the news stories that came up. That was intentional, by the way. He turned off the device for a second.
Dr. Joshua Reese has supervised the project.
Okay, you can skip this guy talking. It's not very interesting. But what I do try and get across there is that it's not meant to replace a sound engineer. It's meant to assist a sound engineer. And when it got discussed on various blogs and forums and things, I think that point was missed. Okay, so we talked about the gain, we talked about preventing feedback, and of course, another common task is setting the delays. So consider a situation where you have a source picked up by two microphones or any variation of the, on that. You could have the direct acoustic sound and electric sound going to the box. But when you add these sounds together, then you essentially have a source added to a delayed version of that source, and that's what's known as comb filtering. You can picture a simple sine wave added to that sine wave completely out of phase, the two are going to cancel. So what that means is you have various frequencies within the spectrum that get notched out and removed. Very common situation, and many times you'll have multiple microphones on an instrument, so you can have a microphone inside and outside a kick drum to get a nice sound between the two, but then you have to correct the delays between those two in order to prevent the comb filtering. And this can occur offline as well. You could have a wet version of an audio effect, and if there isn't any compensation for the latency introduced by that audio effect, then when you add the affected sound to the original sound, again, comb filtering occurs. So it produces this frequency spectrum that, rather than looking flat, introduces all sorts of notches. And there's been a lot of study on this, but there hasn't been that much work trying to correct the problem. You also have the related problem of polarity. So if you take the situation of microphone inside and outside a kick drum, then the signals could be change in sign. And when you add them together, they're going to cancel out if there's no delay. And if there is delay, you're still going to have the comb filtering. So the problem is you have two impulses, looking at the impulse response, and when you add them together, even though they're from the same system, but with a delay, with polarity, you get two impulses or two pulses in the response. What we'd like to do is to correct for that delay, correct for the polarity, and when you add the two together, then you get a nice clean copy of the original signal. So I'm going to play a couple of examples here. The first is the most extreme situation where we've got multiple microphones, many microphones, picking up a single source, and we want to hear what's happening. So, comb filtered. And then correcting all the delays and the polarity. We've corrected every channel. And back to the comb filtered version, and then we're going to correct it one more time. Okay, so I'll play one more example where, in this case, it's a real recording. So it's a saxophone player, and he's moving back and forth from the microphone. So one problem with the comb filtering is if the sources are moving, as they usually are, then the delay is changing over time. And although our system can get the delays right to within a single sample, it needs to update itself all the time and needs to correct for the current position of the source. So here's another example, which again should speak for itself. There's a few YouTube videos that you can find of this in situations where we have the source moving very rapidly, or where we manually edited a path that the source was supposed to take, so not a real recording, but we modify that, and the system can track the appropriate delay as the source moves. So those are most of the technologies we put into automatic mixing. There is also automatic equalization. It does something quite similar to the auto faders, but now rather than trying to attain equal loudness of or equal probability of each source being heard, we're trying to do that over each frequency band. So we run things through a filter bank, process each bank in the filter, and try and do essentially automatic faders for each of the filter banks. So in order to create a full automatic mixing system, we took a lot of these tools and put them all together. And that includes a few tools that we haven't mentioned. So a channel enhancer, just very briefly there. The idea is that if you want to bring up one source in the mix, you don't need to lower all of the sources in the mix to do that. You just need to lower those sources that have very overlapping frequency content. So if you want to make the bass more noticeable, you don't need to change the levels that much on the flute. So by analyzing many sources in a mix, you can figure out the smallest change to the other sources in order to bring up one more. But so we put that into the system, time offset correction that you just saw, auto panners, gains, faders, the EQ that I mentioned, acoustic feedback prevention. We had it all running from a Mackie controller, so you can see all of the levels moving up and down, but we also implemented it in software as well and had a mixing host so that we can really show off the idea or try to automatically mix a complete recording. Now, there's a lot of things that we haven't done. So even a simple mixing console will have dynamic range compression. And although we've worked on automating a single channel dynamic range compressor, we haven't tried to do that in the multi-channel case, the cross-adaptive effect. So there's work is continuing. So I'll play a couple of the examples here. Here we have a source coming in. I'll play just a bit of this. Coming in, and the levels are all pretty horrible. And then we just start turning on the automatic mixing tools one by one. And so I think some of you will recognize the song partway through. So right now, all the levels are horrible. We haven't turned on any of the automatic mixing tools. So everything's being clipped and being distorted. And now all we've turned on is the automatic gain. And now we're about to turn on auto faders. And auto panning. And then, well, you get the idea. So we turn on each of them, and I'm not claiming it's going to sound as good as a professional sound engineer, but it amazes me how far we can take it, because all we're doing is turning on tool after tool. We could have just said automatically mix. And in fact, that's what we do for this next sound example. So for the 128th AES convention, as you know, at the AES conventions, there's student recording competitions. Well, I had an apology to make to the organizers of the student recording competition because I said that I was involved in a submission that had not been mixed by a student. Rather, it had been mixed by software written by students. So, but we didn't tell them beforehand. Now, it didn't win the recording competition. Nowhere close. If it had won, I suppose then a lot of the people in this room would be seriously worried. But the interesting thing is we were able to get some feedback from the people who ran the competition and assessed the recordings. And two of the three who judged that recording were really surprised and said, I had no idea that it had been automatically mixed. The third one said, oh yeah, it sounded, yeah, it was not that different. Oh, by the way, it was automatically mixed. Ah, I knew it from the beginning. So I'll take what he said with a grain of salt there. But also it had problems. You'll hear in the recording there is no dynamic range compression, and it really is a live mix. Now, we did have to cheat a little bit. First take, because it's an adaptive system, it learns over time. First take, it didn't have the settings that good until a bit of a ways into the song, once it had gathered enough information. So we sort of looped the song twice through the system and had it automatically mixed. But it was essentially working like a live situation. The song was recorded live, and then we just ran it through, and it optimized the delays, gains, EQ, everything. So here's just a little bit of that song. So try and listen to this as if you're just critiquing a mix. Is it a good one? Is it a bad one? Would you have set the levels differently? I didn't want to touch anything on this because I wasn't sure. Yeah. Sunrise, make it all this, the way you hold your hand. Sunrise. I'll just jump to the end because the vocal levels intentionally change quite a lot, and so a lot of people would say the levels aren't necessarily right. On the other hand, a lot of people would have kept the levels on the vocals quite high at the end, stylistically. It's sort of, it's intentional for the song. So I think rather than play every sound example, I'll just describe the next bit, and the videos about it are on the web. So talked about automatic mixing, but there is a lot more that can be done, especially, you know, things get mixed, then they get mastered. And remastering is a mini industry of its own. Well, most people who work in remastering say one of the challenges is to begin with a good version of the settings that were produced to the settings that were used to produce the original version. Use that as the starting point and then continue the work. But they don't know what those settings are. Most of the time you're dealing with analog equipment. Speaking with people who do remastering, they said the main thing that they do is they'll get the tracks and there'll be some information, but a lot of it's missing. And so they'll phone up the people who worked on the original recording. Hopefully they're still around. Hopefully they'll remember what had been done, and they fill in a lot of the gaps. And then once they have that, they can then tinker with it for creative decisions or just to attempt to improve the quality and so on. So the challenge for us is a situation where we've got the masters and we've got, say, the CD or the, you know, the final recorded version, and we'd like to figure out, well, what had been done to each of the channels to go from one to the other. And this is applicable for older recordings when not a massive amount has been done. Much more challenging, I think, for modern digital recording, where the recording engineer is always tempted to do as many little things as they can possibly do. So the application, primary one is remastering, retrieve information about how the effects have been applied, and then use that information to begin the remastering process. It can also be used for studying record production, show how famous engineers have worked on a given song, say, oh, look, this is the settings that this engineer used. And then there's this newly emerging standard, Fraunhofer and others are behind it, spatial audio object coding. But what it essentially does is it allows the listener, the consumer, to remix the audio that they've gotten. So they'll be listening on their mobile device and they'll say, no, I want the drums to be quite narrow rather than quite spread, or I want to move things around or change the levels on them. So this allows them to, say, go back to an original setting that someone else had used, figure out different settings that people have used, and so on, you know, find out what setting someone else had chosen. Just a little bit of background. Others had attempted this before. They'd come up with a way to try to reverse engineer what were the levels on the faders. Took maybe a day to run on a multi-track recording and got the level, say, 80, 90% accurate. Used a genetic algorithm to do so. Sometimes we'll get the settings completely wrong. Great result from the researcher Daniela Borghese, where he tried a different approach that's actually based on just least squares, so fairly standard mathematical algorithm, but it produces exact results, minimal computation. And if we look at the standard operations that are done, so applying gains, delay, stereo panning, equalization, all the ones that were mentioned in automatic mixing, well, they're all just part of one big EQ. When you apply delay, that can be embedded into an EQ curve, similarly gains and delays and so on. So if we can reverse engineer the EQ, then we can say, right, if we assume that the delay was zero in the equalization, all the rest of the delay that we're finding is essentially what was done on the delay knob on the mixing console. Similarly, if we assume the EQ curve has a normalized value of 1, then any gain is applied on the faders, and so on. So we can estimate all of them, and also we can apply this in a time-varying approach, where we look essentially window by window, try to get the estimate, and that allows us to get the gain envelopes for any dynamic range effects, noise gates, expanders, compressors, limiters, and so on. So this had been done, but video is available on the website, so I'll let you look at that at your leisure. And the video does show, by the way, him mixing a piece of audio and then reverse engineer and using, I think, logic to do it, and then reverse engineering that using the software that's been created. So, conclusions. Well, we talked about a variety of different audio editing technologies, all of which can be made simpler, easier to use by embedding intelligence and adaptive effects. We can take the best rules in record production, in mixing, in live sound, and embed them into the systems, embed them into the tools. Allows us to automate the repetitive and the technical tasks, and I like to think that, like with most industries, when you make one level simple or you make it unnecessary to do one level, people then do more on the level above it. And so if you make those repetitive tasks unnecessary to do, then people do more creative things on a more advanced level. So hopefully this will allow a new level of innovation to emerge. But contrary to some of the discussion about the work that has occurred, we aren't trying to remove the creativity. So the idea is today's technology is really only for the expert. A horrible way to say it is a lot of sound engineers today are button pushers. Now, it requires a degree, it requires a lot of training, it requires a lot of knowledge to figure out what buttons to push and when, because those systems are non-trivial, but essentially they're pushing buttons. Yeah. Really, they should be creative and doing the more interesting, the more challenging aspects of the work. So today's technology is only for the expert. You can see I'm not a user interface designer, but ideally, hopefully, tomorrow's technology will be for everyone. Okay, so thanks to everyone who worked on this, and all of the information and videos are available on the web.
Thank you very much, Joss. Do we have questions for our speaker? We have one at the back here, hold on. If you could just identify yourself and...
Hi, Matthew from Arcam. I've got a background in audio amplifiers, as I'm sure a few people have here, and it brought to my mind with the feedback case, it's similar problems to making an audio amplifier stable, and there's the concept of phase margin. I just wondered that, as well as adjusting gain in that case, had you thought about DSP techniques to manipulate the phase of the signal to give yourself more headroom before feedback?
Well, we tried to stay away from anything that would modify the phase or shift the content in any way. So a lot of the work on feedback prevention has come from improving speech intelligibility, where you can make modifications to the phase. So if feedback is occurring at a particular frequency, you simply vary the phase of the input signal to prevent the feedback from occurring. But if you do that to music, it's not going to sound very good. So we tried to stay away from those approaches. Now, I'm not sure, is that kind of...
I can see the thinking behind that. I don't know if you're aware that certainly it's a trick I've done as an amateur live sound engineer. If all else fails, you can always try the polarity button on the channel to see if you get a little bit more gain before feedback.
Yeah.
So,
I think the feedback prevention tool is intended for that situation where you know you want to boost, you have no more options, but you know that if you were to boost the signal at that point, you'd be out of headroom. So we're not addressing the wider situations.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, question up here.
Thank you. Sean Davis. In the examples of comb filtering through multi-mics, they were very extreme, and I'm assuming that the studio use was very dead, because ambience would normally reduce the effect, surely, of comb filtering, because it would come in as rather random. And when I've multi-mic'd things like an acoustic guitar, whatever, I've never had such an extreme example as you demonstrated.
The first example was intended to be really extreme, to show an exaggerated version of the effect. I'm aware of one research paper where they looked into the audibility of comb filtering and found that if the source is recorded as much as 18 dBs less on one of the channels than the other one, it's still quite audible. For the second example I played, the saxophone player was asked, just play as you would normally play. We weren't telling him to move wildly around or anything like that. So that was intended to be to demonstrate that it makes a noticeable difference under realistic conditions.
But was the studio really dead?
Yeah. It wasn't. It was meant to be good recording conditions. It wasn't an anechoic space or anything like that. There were reflections, there was some reverberation, but it was essentially a recording studio-like environment.
Further to what you've just said about 18 decibels of spill between two microphones being problematic, that introduces a problem which your system can't solve, which is the one where if you have two spot mics on different instruments and one is spilling onto the other and you have this mutual spill, simple delay cannot correct it. Is there anything else that you can do in order to mitigate that problem, or do you just have to know about spill to begin with?
It's ongoing research, that. So that's specifically one we're trying to address. So multiple options could work there. In an ideal case, if you can separate the sources, then you can modify the delays as you wish and modify them however. Sometimes you may not be able to separate the sources, but what might be sufficient is you'd like on the mixing console that if someone is changing the EQ on one channel, that it really is truly changing the EQ on that source. Yeah. Even if the sources haven't been separated, still in the final recombined mix of the sources, you're able to process them. But the approach that we've been looking at started off with simple ones. So say, try to determine where the comb filtering is most problematic and correct for that one. You may have many different sources, and there's comb filtering in one way and comb filtering the other way. And you can correct, if you correct for one, you're introducing more on the other, but you at least sort of prioritize it. The other thing we've been looking at are variations on echo cancellation to try and deal with multiple sources comb filtering.
Well, that's a can of worms.
Sorry?
That's a can of worms.
Yeah.
So. Oh, good stuff.
You talked about having an established set of kind of best practice rules, which inform the mix. How does varying those rules affect the outcome? And can you vary those rules in subtle ways so as to influence, say, I want this to be mixed in a certain style, for example, or is that subtlety missed in terms of the process?
Yeah, so far we haven't run into situations where the rules are sort of contradicting each other and we need to rate them, but it really is varying how we implement a rule. So we have this rule of thumb, and we know there are situations where it may not make sense, or we know it's more a guideline than a hard and fast rule, but where we want to make sure that each source that is playing approaches equal loudness. Now, we could make it approach equal loudness very quickly or very slowly. And if you do it very quickly, then the faders are all moving back and forth rapidly. So we said, well, let's try and move the faders at the same rate as a human would when operating the mixing console. We've also done some evaluation on the automatic mixing tools. So when I explained the single channel transient modification and compression, there'd been a fair amount of evaluation. The only automatic mixing tool where we've done exhaustive evaluation was the stereo panning. And we had two implementations of the stereo panner, and we had experts who'd panned, and we had an amateur who panned, and then we asked a set of experts, by experts I mean, you know, people doing it for a living, a set of experts to then do A-B testing, so, you know, which mix do you prefer. Essentially, they actually ranked the automatic, they ranked one of the two automatic panners equivalent to the experts. They ranked the other one equivalent to the amateurs, and they did rank the amateur one worse than the expert one. That actually surprised us. We didn't think we'd do that good. Maybe we just got lucky. So we haven't varied the rules, but we have varied the implementation of those rules. And yeah, the mixes do sound a bit different there.
Because the system is essentially blind.
Yeah.
So how does it cope with situations where, for example, you might have a singer and a backing singer? How does it cope with, if it's going for equal loudness, that's probably not what you want.
In that situation, it would do it very, you know, it wouldn't know. So it would probably put those two on either side. So what we tried with the stereo panner. In fact, every one of the other tools, when we published, it's an automatic delay correction. But for the panner, we called it semi-autonomous. Because we said, well, the channels are going to have priority. We don't know who's lead vocalist, who's backup vocalist. But if the lead is on channel one and, say, the backing vocalist is channel two or channel three, then we assume that whichever is on the lower number channel, that's going to be the higher priority. So that's what's semi-autonomous, because we would love to have a little bit of additional information. And maybe we could get some of that from, say, instrument identification and a few other techniques, but we didn't have it. So we had priorities. So in that situation where you've got channels with overlapping frequency content, and one of those channels is going to go to the center, then it chooses the lowest priority, or the highest priority, the lowest number channel to do so.
Excuse me.
Have you tried the system on a large classical recording, and particularly opera, where you don't want equalization related to the same thing? What happens in a case like that?
Well, I think you can guess the answer to that question. No, we haven't tried it. We certainly don't expect it to work on a large recording. Most of the work that we did in the multi-channel case, we looked at 8 channels. Partly because of the processing power of the laptop we were using. It couldn't do cross-adaptive effect processing on more than 8 channels in a live situation. So we haven't really looked at that, but, and I think this is very interesting, we have looked at different genres. We've looked at jazz, pop, rock, etc. And our initial thought is, well, it might work for pop, it's not going to work for jazz. But most of the rules that we're dealing with seem to be somewhat universal rules. You know, you want to eliminate, you don't want masking of sources, whether it's this type of genre or that type of genre. So that also addresses one criticism that people have said. Someone will say, well, I mix totally differently if it's heavy metal or if it's R&B. And that's true, but that's because the signal coming in is quite different. The instrumentation is coming quite different. Still, the initial step of the mixing is to eliminate the masking, prevent the comb filtering, and so on. So we haven't dealt with that example. I don't think it would work, but I think a lot of the concepts would still apply.
Except you don't want the people learning in classical recording.
Yeah, but you do want all of the sources to be heard. So we never...
It's often it's a combination, often it's a combination of sources rather than a single source.
Yeah. One of the things we've done is try to come up with an automatic rider. So you might have heard of the Vocal Rider plugin. So we say, right, throughout this recording, we're going to set channel one to be the lead vocal. And so it sets that 3 decibels higher than all the others throughout the recording. So if we know what the rules are in a situation, we can embed them into the system. When I said we want them all to be heard, what I meant is that if a violin player is playing, you don't want them, you don't want the level on that to be so low as to not be heard at all. It might be intended to be blended in with everything, but you don't want it to be purely unheard. Not contributing anything. So there is a range of levels that you want to set things to.
Okay, got time for a couple more questions.
In the live environment, how does your system deal with the human things like plugging and unplugging guitars and dropping the microphone and not being anywhere near the microphone at the right time and that sort of thing? How did it cope with those very loud transient noises? How did it affect the overall mix?
It does a few things. I'm certainly not claiming, you know, it's ready to go on the market or anything like that. So we are accumulating information about the signal. So if that was a loud temporary sound, then within a short amount of time, that will be weighted a lot less. If it's a continual sound, then we think that's part of the signal, and so that contributes to the weighting. We have used a reference microphone, so we have a level of the ambient sound in the environment. So that allows us to deal with the very quiet sounds. You know, let's suppose there's a lot of background noise. We know that if we're measuring a single channel and it's on the same range as the background noise, then it's not actually active. And so we don't attribute that one to what's going on. So I would guess if someone plugs in the guitar, you hear a loud sound, it would immediately try to drop the levels on that guitar, but then very quickly raise them back up to a normal level. And we can set things so that it operates in, 10 milliseconds or a couple of seconds.
Good. Well, if we don't have any more questions, nice to have a presentation that's not a product pitch. Thank you very much. And I think another big hand for Josh. That's a really interesting lecture. Thank you.